All right, so get ready, because today we are going deep, diving into the sometimes controversial world of biblical criticism.
Oh, yeah, it can definitely get a little heated sometimes.
But don't worry, though, we are not here to, like, bash the Bible or anything like that.
Yeah, not at all.
We just really want to understand how it came to be and, you know, like,
right,
how those ancient writings were put together. And, you know, it's kind of like, mm-hmm, imagine those archaeologists carefully excavating a site, right?
Absolutely.
We're using tools like source criticism and form criticism to kind of piece together those clues.
Yeah, it's a lot like detective work. You know, you're sifting through the evidence, trying to understand, you know,
yeah, exactly,
the Bible's origins and how it developed over time.
Mm-hmm. And with source criticism, it's like we're putting on our Sherlock Holmes hats, right?
Yeah.
Trying to figure out if the biblical authors might have used earlier documents or tradition.
Right.
And I've always wondered about, like, the similarities between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you know, the synoptic gospels.
Oh, absolutely.
How do scholars even begin to untangle that?
It's like a puzzle, right? And
yeah,
for centuries, many scholars, they thought Matthew was written first.
Oh, interesting.
Even going all the way back to Augustine, you know.
Wow.
He thought Matthew, being a tax collector, you know, he would have been pretty good with words.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. He would have been keeping all those records, right?
Exactly. He would have been used to that.
So what changed?
Well, you know, scholars over time, they started to notice some interesting things. They noticed that Mark's gospel, it's shorter, you know, not as fancy.
Kind of rough around the edges.
Yeah, exactly. Like a rough draft almost.
Oh, okay.
While Matthew and Luke, you know, they seem to kind of smooth things out.
Gotcha.
Add more details. So this led to the theory of Mark and priority.
Okay, Mark and priority.
And this is basically the idea that Mark wrote his gospel first.
Okay.
And then Matthew and Luke, they used his as a source.
So they were like building on his foundation.
Oh, exactly. Building on Mark's foundation.
Wow. That is really interesting.
Yeah. And to add even more intrigue to the puzzle, Matthew and Luke, they share some stuff that's not even in Mark.
Really? Like what?
Like the Sermon on the Mount.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So this is where the mysterious Q source comes in.
Okay. So the Q source. So this is like a...
It's like a theoretical collection of Jesus's sayings and teachings.
Gotcha.
That scholars believe Matthew and Luke both used.
So it's kind of like a missing piece of the puzzle.
Exactly, like a missing piece of the puzzle.
That could maybe explain those similarities.
Yeah, and it really makes you wonder what else might be out there.
It does, it really does.
But it is important to remember we don't actually have a copy of this Q document.
Right, right. It's hypothetical.
It's still just a theory.
That's true.
But, you know, if it were ever found,
yeah,
boy, it would really change things.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's fun to think about.
It is. It's fun to speculate, for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, this whole idea of lost sources and, you know, potential borrowing, that's not just limited to the Gospels, right?
No, not at all.
It seems like it pops up all over the Bible.
Oh, yeah. All over the place.
Like in the Old Testament, for example.
Yeah.
You see some pretty clear borrowing between like Chronicles,
yes,
and Kings and Samuel.
The language is so similar.
Really?
Yeah. It's striking. It really suggests that, you know, one author
the other
was familiar with the other's work. Yeah.
So it's kind of like the ancient equivalent of like, hey, I really like that. Do you mind if I use it?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I like that passage. Can I quote you?
Exactly.
And then you have the Pentateuch, which is even more complex.
Okay, the Pentateuch. So that's the first five books, right?
Yep, the first five books of the Old Testament.
Okay.
And scholars have come up with this theory, the JGPD theory.
JGP, okay.
Which proposes that these books were actually woven together from multiple sources.
Oh, wow.
Each with its own style and perspective on God.
So break it down for me. What does JEPD stand for?
Okay, so each letter stands for a hypothetical source.
Gotcha.
So J, that's for the Yahweh source. E for the Elohist.
Okay.
D for the Deuteronomist. And P for the priestly source.
Okay, wow. That is a lot.
It's a lot to keep track of.
It is. It's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, but what's really interesting is that it suggests that the Pentateuch wasn't just like dictated by God to one person.
Right.
It might be a compilation, you know, of different voices and perspectives.
Wow. So does that mean we can't really be sure what Moses actually wrote?
That's one of the big questions that comes up.
Yeah.
You know, it really challenges our traditional understanding of authorship and encourages us to kind of look at the text with fresh eyes.
Okay.
Now, not all scholars agree with this theory.
Right.
Some see a lot of unity in the Pentateuch and argue for a single author or maybe a small group working really closely together. But
right, yeah,
the debate itself, I think, is really valuable because it pushes us to think critically about how these texts came to be.
So even in like the world of biblical scholarship.
Yeah.
There's room for debate and disagreement.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of reassuring.
Yeah.
I think it means it's okay to ask these questions and kind of wrestle with the complexity of it all.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so fascinating.
It really does.
And as we dig deeper into source criticism, we find all these little hints.
Oh, really?
Of earlier texts and lost traditions.
Wow.
And maybe even, you know, competing voices within the Bible itself.
So we've been talking about how source criticism helps us identify those potential sources.
Right.
And figure out how they were woven together. But what about like those individual pieces, you know, those building blocks of the Bible? That's where form criticism comes in, right?
Exactly. That's where we zoom in and take a closer look at those individual pieces.
So it's like we've been looking at the whole scaffolding of a building.
Right.
But now we want to understand like the individual bricks and how they fit together.
Yeah, exactly. Form criticism, it kind of zooms in on the literary features of those bricks, those individual units of text.
Right. To understand their original function and purpose.
Okay.
It's kind of like finding, you know, an ancient artifact and not just admiring it, but trying to figure out how it was used in its original context.
So instead of like focusing on where those pieces came from, we're analyzing their shape, their style.
Yeah.
And what they might tell us about the people who created them.
Exactly.
Okay, I need a concrete example here.
Okay.
How would we apply form criticism to something like we use every day?
Well, think about a text message.
Okay, a text message.
Right, a form critic would analyze its structure.
Okay.
Is it short bursts or is it longer, you know, more thought out?
Right.
They look at the language, formal, informal emojis, no emojis.
Right.
Then they look at the purpose.
Okay.
Is it giving information, expressing emotion, or asking for something.
Gotcha. So it's not just about deciphering the words, but like understanding the form itself.
Exactly. The conventions and the nuances of the form.
And when we apply this to the Bible, it's like a whole new level of understanding opens up.
Wow.
Take the Psalms, for instance.
Okay, yeah.
Form criticism has helped us identify all these categories of Psalms.
Right.
Each with its own unique features and functions.
Like there are praise Psalms, lament Psalms.
Exactly.
Thanksgiving Psalms. It's like, you know, a whole spectrum of human emotion, but in poetic form.
Yeah, exactly. And each type has its own structure, language, purpose.
Okay.
Think about the entrance Psalms, like Psalm 15.
Entrance Psalms.
These are probably sung as worshipers entered the temple in Jerusalem.
Oh, so the setting itself, like, shapes the meaning?
Oh, absolutely. Imagine you're a pilgrim approaching the temple.
Okay.
You hear this psalm being sung, and it lays out the requirements for entering God's presence.
Oh, wow.
You know, he whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart.
So it's kind of like a spiritual checklist.
Yeah, it's like a checklist.
Setting the tone for the whole worship experience.
Exactly. And form criticism lets us see these nuances.
Right.
You know, understand how these texts functioned in their original setting.
Okay, so we got these entrance psalms.
Right.
What other examples of form criticism can you share?
Well, let's look at the call narratives.
Call narrative.
That we find throughout the Old Testament.
Okay.
Think about Moses and the burning bush.
Right.
Isaiah's vision in the temple.
So these are like those moments when God calls someone.
Yes.
To a specific task or mission.
Exactly. And the fascinating thing is,
yeah,
these narratives often follow a very similar structure.
Really?
There's the confrontation with the divine.
Okay.
Often overwhelming and awe-inspiring.
Right, right.
Then comes the commission, God's specific instructions for that person.
But it's never that easy, is it?
You're right. There's almost always an objection.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they protest, they feel inadequate. Sometimes they even refuse.
Yeah.
Moses says he's slow of speech.
Right.
Jeremiah says he's only a child.
That's such a human response.
It is. It's so human.
Right.
Which makes these narratives really relatable.
Yeah, I can see that.
But then, of course, God offers reassurance, overcomes their objections, and often gives a sign to confirm the call.
Like Moses' staff turning into a snake.
Exactly.
Or Isaiah's lips being touched by a burning coal.
Those vivid images.
Yeah.
They really stick with you.
They do. And that's the power of form criticism.
Okay.
It helps us appreciate those details.
Okay.
Understand how the structure reinforces the message.
So we've seen how it can illuminate individual psalms and those like dramatic call narratives.
Yeah.
But how does it help us make sense of like
larger
portions of the Bible, like a whole gospel?
Well, look at the Gospel of Matthew, for example.
Yeah.
Chapters 8 and 9. You find all these miracle stories, one after another.
Right.
Form criticism helps us see that Matthew arranged these stories very deliberately.
Oh, to emphasize Jesus's authority.
Really?
Yeah, over sickness, over nature, even over demons.
So the way they're arranged is like sending a message.
Yeah, it's not random. It's sending a theological message.
Wow.
Matthew is shaping his material using those individual bricks
right.
to build this larger argument
Got
about
that.
Who Jesus is and what he came to do.
That's fascinating. It's like we're seeing the artistry
right.
of the gospel writer.
Yeah.
How they're using literary techniques to shape our understanding of Jesus.
And that brings us to one of the most intriguing and challenging genres in the Bible. The parables.
Oh, yeah. The parables of Jesus.
These short little stories that have captivated readers for centuries.
Right.
And form criticism gives us a powerful way to understand them.
Okay. So what can form criticism reveal about those parables?
That is a great question. And one we'll have to explore in our next deep dive.
Ooh, a cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger. Stay tuned.
This whole discussion has just, wow, it's really opened my eyes. I mean, the Bible is not just like one book, right? It's like this tapestry. Woven together, all these different sources,
yeah,
each one with its own style, its own perspective.
And both source and form criticism, you know, they can help us see that.
Yeah, they give us tools to kind of peel back those layers
mm-hmm.
to understand not just what it says, but how it says it and why.
Right.
And what's really fascinating to me is how these approaches, you know,
yeah.
they make us rethink authorship.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always about like finding that one person who wrote every single word.
Right.
Sometimes it's more about like a community,
mm-hmm.
a tradition
right.
that evolves over time.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
The Bible, you know, it's not this like dictation from on high.
Right.
It's a human product, you know,
yeah.
human hands and minds grappling with their understanding of God.
Right.
And the world around them.
And recognizing that human element, I think just.
I think so, too.
Makes it even more powerful.
Absolutely.
So we can hear those ancient voices
yeah.
in a new way.
It brings them to life.
It really does.
Yeah.
And by understanding, like, the historical context,
mm-hmm.
the literary context,
right.
we can really appreciate the richness and diversity of the biblical tradition.
Absolutely.
So where do we go from here? I mean, do we have to become biblical scholars?
Well, I don't think that's necessary.
You really understand it.
But I do think it's important to approach the Bible with curiosity
right
and humility
okay
you know to ask those tough questions
right
to be okay with the ambiguity
yeah
to realize that there are multiple layers of meaning
mm-hmm. and sometimes those layers might even contradict each other
right exactly like the JEPD theory you
yeah.
know suggests that the Pentateuch might reflect different theological viewpoints
yeah that's a good point so are those tensions like something to be afraid of
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they're an invitation to engage more deeply.
Okay.
You know, wrestle with the text.
Yeah.
Let it challenge your assumptions.
So it's not just about understanding the Bible. It's about understanding ourselves, too.
Yeah. Well said. I think that's a really good point.
Our own place in this tradition.
It's about recognizing that the Bible's not just a museum piece.
Right.
It's a living document.
Yeah.
That speaks to us, you know, across the centuries.
Yeah. I like
invites
it.
Us into this dialogue
You're
that
right.
can deepen our faith and enrich our lives.
That's a great point to end on. And for our listeners, you know, if you're wanting to keep exploring.
Yeah.
We have some amazing resources in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Everything from like introductory articles mm-hmm. to some more scholarly stuff if you want to really dig in.
And remember, the journey of biblical understanding, it never really ends.
That's true.
There's always something new to discover.
Yeah. Yeah.
To ponder, to be challenged by.
So keep those minds open. Keep asking questions
mm-hmm.
and keep diving deep into this fascinating world of the Bible.
Exactly.
Until next time.